So, welcome back, everybody. Or at least those who were not scared away last time. So let's remember where we were. We said we have a manifold M, and it consists of abstract points. These points need names so that we can address them. And for that, we came up with the concept of a chart or coordinate system. It works like this. You take some open patch of your manifold and you map it into some patch of Rn so that every point gets mapped of the manifold gets mapped into a point of Rn. And in this way, these points in Rn, which can be described by n real numbers, provide the names for the points of the manifold. And then, of course, we said we will look at an atlas, which is a collection of charts like this, which will cover the entire manifold. Okay, so now we can describe the points of our manifold through vectors in Rn, through their coordinates. The next concept we need is that of a tangent space. So how can we define the abstract tangent space to a point? The tangent space to a point will be denoted by Tp of m, tangent space at the point P of m. Now intuitively, of course, we want that if this is the manifold, at every point P, we have a tangent space. Thank you. We have a tangent space that is isomorphic to Rn. Okay, so if the manifold is n-dimensional, we expect that any reasonable definition of a tangent space would give us that at every point there's a tangent space which is isomorphic to Rn. How to do this? How to define tangent vectors? It turns out that there are at least three equivalent definitions of what the tangent space is at the point P of a manifold M. The modern way to define a tangent space is the first one that we will cover. And then we will go historically back into the old times. So the first definition of a tangent space that we will cover is the algebraic definition of a tangent space. And the algebraic definition of a tangent space is using the following idea. Consider, for example, the function e to the power x. How do you define that? What is it? Well, you can write it as e to the sum over n equals 0 to infinity, and then you have x to the power n over n factorial. So you have to give a lot of detail here to specify what e of x is, e to the power x is. But there's another way, a more elegant way, to describe a complicated thing such as e of x. Namely, you can say, consider the function f of x, which has the property that f of 0 is 1 and f prime is f. This is also a description of the exponential function. There's only one that has this property. Okay? So instead of specifying exactly what it does, you can specify sufficiently many of its properties, and that will specify it as well. And often, this is not just more elegant, it's more powerful. As we will see, derivatives are usually defined in the, at least in undergrad studies, derivatives would be defined usually the tedious way, the Newton-Leibniz way, where you would say that f prime of x is equal to limit h to 0, and then you have f of x plus h minus f of x divided by h. This is analogous to giving the exponential function explicitly, tedious. There is another way to describe what a derivative is, which is way more powerful and applies also when we don't have limits or anything of that kind. So instead of the analytic definition of a derivative, there is an algebraic definition of the derivative. And the definition of a tangent space will be, the algebraic definition will be similar. We will define, we will specify, we will identify tangent vectors through algebraic properties. Okay? That will be the general idea. And what will be these algebraic properties? Just like we can specify the exponential function by saying it's the function that is 1 at 0 and its own derivative. Here we will say a tangent vector is defined by the following general idea, algebraic description. A tangent vector intuitively points out a direction, right? And there is the notion of directional derivative. If you work in Rn, you can differentiate your function in the x1 direction, or you can differentiate in the x2 direction or in the x3 direction. These are directional derivatives, right? So whatever direction you choose, you can differentiate in this direction. For example, if your function is the temperature as a function of the location, then you pick a point and you can calculate how does the temperature change if I travel in this direction or that direction or that direction. This will be directional derivatives. And clearly, the number of directional derivatives that there are is the same as the number of directions there are, because you can differentiate in any direction you want. So the overall intuition here for the algebraic definition is this. We can identify tangent vectors with directional derivatives, because both are in one-to-one correspondence to choosing a direction. A tangent vector clearly points in a direction, and a directional derivative differentiates in a direction. So therefore, tangent vectors and directional derivatives should be in one-to-one correspondence. Both are identified by giving a direction. But directional derivatives, and that's the key now, directional derivatives are derivatives after all. And I promised you that derivatives can be defined not just the Newton-Leibniz way with a limit taking, but also algebraically, much more elegantly. Just like this is more elegant than that. So derivatives can be singled out differently, algebraically, namely this way. It turns out that derivatives are uniquely those operations that obey the Leibniz rule. See, the derivative of the product of two functions is given by the derivative of the first times the second plus the first times the derivative of the second. That's the Leibniz rule. And that's not just some property that the derivative obeys. It's the property that the derivative obeys. It's basically this for the exponential function. It's the more algebraic, it's the more elegant way of defining what a derivative is. So the strategy in the algebraic modern definition of a tangent space is to say, first of all, tangent vectors will be identified with directional derivatives. And directional derivatives are going to be those linear operations on functions which obey the Leibniz rule, the product rule. Okay? We need that kind of definition if we want to differentiate functions on an abstract manifold. Right? Because in the abstract manifold, everything is pretty abstract. We can't really work with numbers directly. It's an abstract concept. And so we define things abstractly through their properties, not by specifying exactly how they operate, but by their properties. That's enough. OK, so we will do this today, the algebraic definition of tangent spaces. But let me already give you a preview of what the other two definitions are. Well, the second is the physicist's definition of a tangent space, the definition that, for example, Einstein used. And you've probably seen that in the first course on general relativity. The physicist's definition of a tangent space is based on the idea that the elements of a tangent space are vectors that are recognizable by how their components change in a change of coordinates. Right? If you remember, if you change coordinates, contravariant vectors transform their coefficients one way, covariant vectors transform their coefficients another way. And in this way, you can tell which is a tangent vector, which is a cotangent vector. We will review that definition too. But it's not going to be really good. We sometimes will use it because it's convenient. But it's not powerful enough because it refers to coordinates and coordinate changes. But if you really want to see how general relativity describes space-time, then we must understand it independently of any coordinate systems. Just like in quantum mechanics, we want to understand things abstractly in the Hilbert space, not tied to any position representation or something like that. Yeah, and then finally, there is the original, oldest definition, which is the geometric definition of what a tangent space is. And here, the elements of the tangent space to a point P are defined to be the actual tangent vectors of one-dimensional paths that are paths in the manifold and pass through our point P. So you have an actual one-dimensional path that you may travel. It passes through the point P, and this path has an actual tangent vector and the set of all possible tangents, tangent vectors to pass through P would form the tangent vector space. Again, we will use that on occasion as well, but again, it's not the most powerful definition. So the three definitions are equivalent, and we will need all three occasionally. So we will do all three. Today, let's start with the algebraic definition. Now, let me warn you that this might get a little tedious. It might look a little tedious, but it's powerful. So let me explain. For example, we can define the exponential function using these properties here. And how would we do that? See, we would actually have to do a bit of a tedious calculation. We would say, I know that my function has these properties, but what is it exactly? So what I can do is, I can, let's say I have no idea about this, right? I only know that. How would I find out that this is the case? Well, I would write f as a power series, and I would have to find out what its coefficients are, right? So I would say, okay, assume f of x is equal to sum over all n equals 0 to infinity, and then x to the power n coefficients a n. Now, I know that if I differentiate this function, I should get back the same function. So what happens is that if I differentiate this thing, I get this n down and I get n minus 1. I get the same series again, but everything is shifted by n. And then you have to work out a little bit of algebra to find out that if the an are 1 over n factorial, this will work out. Because every time you differentiate with respect to x, the n factorial, because an n comes down, becomes n minus 1 factorial. And you can rename your summation variable, and so the whole thing closes in itself, right? So it takes a little bit of calculation to go from the abstract specification to what it is concretely. And so here, too, we are working with an abstract specification of what a derivative is. And it will take a little bit of calculation to recover the ordinary explicit definition of derivatives in cases where we have the derivatives by other means. OK, so the algebraic definition of tangent spaces. Let me remind you, we will identify tangent vectors with directional derivatives because both are in one-to-one correspondence to choices of actual direction. And then secondly, directional derivatives are, in particular, derivatives. And derivatives can be identified, as we will see, by their property of obeying the Leibniz rule. Here's a key example. Let's say our manifold is Rn itself. In this case, we know how derivatives work. In this case, we know how to write down directional derivatives. Let's see how we recover that from the abstract definition. So on one hand, because we are dealing with Rn, it is as if we already know what e of x, e to the power x is, right? So this is a simple case. And so we do the analog of going from the abstract to the concrete. All right, so if the manifold is Rn, then we know from prior knowledge that the tangent vectors xi at the point p are identifiable from with the directional first derivatives, as we said. Right? You can differentiate in the x direction, or the y direction, or the z direction, or in any linear combination of them. So you can differentiate in any direction you want, for example, to find out if the function f is the temperature as a function of space. You can find out at what rate the temperature is changing if you go this way, that way, or that way. Okay, so here are all possible first derivatives. A general first derivative is a linear combination of the first derivative in the first direction, first derivative in the second direction, first derivative in the third direction, and so on. So these are all the partial derivatives, and we look at linear combinations of them. For example, if only the first xi I coefficient was 1 and all the others are 0, then this is the directional derivative in the x1 direction. Okay, so we know that all directional derivatives look like this. So then, the tangent vectors at the point P should be those maps. So the tangent vectors xi, we will denote the tangent vectors always with xi. The tangent vectors xi should be maps which map functions into the directional derivative of that function, which is to say the function f is being mapped into a number. The number is obtained by taking all the partial derivatives and putting weights on them, evaluate all of that at the point. That's the number. This is the rate at which the temperature would change, for example, in a particular direction. So the tangent vectors should be all those maps which have this property and which, because they're partial derivatives, obey the Leibniz rule at the point. And here it is. So if we apply the directional derivative on the product of two functions, then it should be the directional derivative on the first function times the second plus the first function times the directional derivative of the second. All of this evaluated at a point. So this is really a number. That's a number. That's a number. And this is a number. Now, I was a little sloppy in this, because when we write it like this, we are thinking intuitively that we're differentiating that function everywhere. But that's not what it is about, right? We are calculating the directional derivative at a point of the manifold. So in this algebraic definition, we're going to construct a tangent space to one point of the manifold. Later, we will consider other points as well. But for now, just happy defining the tangent space at one point of the manifold. Therefore, also calculating only partial derivatives or directional derivatives at one point of the manifold. So our directional derivatives don't actually act on the functions per se. They act only on the functions around that point. I mean, on the values of the function in the immediate neighborhood, infinitesimal neighborhood of that point. So how can we express the local nature of what we are doing here? How can we express that properly? Well, the proper way to do that is to say that our directional derivative vectors, xi, our directional derivatives, our tangent vectors, act not on functions, but on function germs. What the hell is a function germ then? Here's the definition. Assume that M and N are differentiable manifolds, and P is a point in the first of the two manifolds. Then we say that two functions from M to N, two functions phi and psi, are germ equivalent about the point P if the two functions do the exact same thing in some neighborhood of our point. So if there is a neighborhood of our point P, U, if there's a neighborhood U of our point P such that the map phi from M to N does the exact same thing as the map psi from M to N, then we say that these are germ equivalent functions. Every such equivalence class of functions is called a germ of a function at the point P. You see, our directional derivatives really act only on those guys. And they act the same way on all of those guys. If you have the directional derivative in some direction and you apply it to a function, you get some value. If you apply it to another function of the same term, you will get the same value. Why? Well, because the two functions agree with each other in a neighborhood of the point. So therefore, they have the exact same behavior in some finite neighborhood of the point. And that's all you need to calculate a derivative. So each equivalence class of functions is called a germ of a function at P. So in particular, we can pick a function, let's say phi, and then we can define its germ. We can look at all those functions that are germ equivalent with it. And let's call them phi p bar. So this is the equivalence class of all those functions which agree with phi, which do the exact same thing as phi, in some neighborhood of p. It doesn't have to be the same neighborhood for all of those functions in the same germ, but there just has to exist one. This is just a tedious way of expressing that the directional derivatives don't see the function everywhere. They see it only locally. And so what are they really acting on? They're really acting only on the germs of these functions. And they're acting the same with the derivative. The directional derivative will give the same value for all elements of one of these germ equivalence classes. So what our directional derivatives are really acting on are these germ equivalence classes. Gives one value for one germ equivalence class and another value for another germ equivalence class, but within one germ equivalence class, the derivatives come out the same. Okay, so this is just the math-only way of writing it down. We say that psi is in the germ equivalence class of phi around p. Equivalence class means that we put this bar on it. Okay, so phi is one representative of that germ equivalence class, and then it generates an entire equivalence class. We put the bar on it. So psi is an element of the germ equivalence class of phi if there exists an open neighborhood of p such that for all points in that open neighborhood, we have that phi does the same as psi. OK, now let's assume that phi is a map that's differentiable from M to N at the point P in the manifold. Then clearly, all functions in that germ equivalence class possess the same first derivative at P, because these functions behave exactly the same in some finite neighborhood. OK, now let's apply this. It's a simple example. Let's consider the germs of a scalar function f. So here we have some manifold, and the image manifold is just chosen to be R. The real line is a manifold 2, differentiable manifold. OK, so here we have a manifold, we have a point P, and then we have a function that's just a scalar function that maps onto the real line, this function f. So f maps from M into R. Now, in order to specify the germ of a function, it suffices to specify any arbitrary element of this germ, because all the others are in germ equivalent, and we know what that means. It means that they have to agree in some open neighborhood around the point P. Then the set of all germs at P is denoted by f of P. Intuitively, the space of functions in the neighborhood of P, but technically, it's the germs of functions. Now, what properties do we have for these function germs? I'm a little warm here. So let's assume that f and g are function germs, not necessarily of the same equivalence class. So they're two different. F and g are functions that generate, in general, different germ equivalence classes. And let's assume that c is some real number. Then c times a germ equivalence class is given by c times one of the functions of the class and then forming the class. So whether we first multiply and then form the general occurrence class, or first form the general occurrence class and then multiply with a number, it's the same thing. And the same is true for the products of functions, whether we first multiply them and then form the general equivalence class or the other way around, doesn't matter. And the same with addition. All of that is fairly simple because we know that these functions, the forming the general equivalence class means that we are considering all those functions that anyway do the same exact thing on a neighborhood. Okay, let's keep those properties in mind. We will need them a little later. So we can multiply, we can pull real numbers out of the German equivalence, of the formation of a German equivalence class. We can multiply first or second with respect to forming German equivalence classes, and we can also do that with addition. Addition commutes with forming German equivalence classes. Okay, so overall, the germs form an associative algebra. Remember what an associative algebra is, right? You need to have an addition that is commutative, and you need to have a multiplication that doesn't have to be commutative, and you need to have associativity, and you need to have a distributive law between them. And the whole thing has to happen over a field, such as the real or the complex numbers, and we have that. So by these axioms, we can call the space of function germs f of p around the point P an associative algebra. That's going to be important later because we are going to consider maps that preserve this algebra structure. All right. So we are now ready for the formal definition of the tangent space, the formal algebraic definition of the tangent space to a manifold. Remember the idea? The elements of the tangent space will be identified with first derivatives. And first derivatives, or directional derivatives, are definable by their, or identifiable by their property of obeying the Leibniz rule. So this is a definition. This can be viewed as the starting point for defining what is a tangent space, what is a tangent vector. But the algebraic definition of tangent space is this. The tangent space to a manifold M at the point P is the set of so-called derivations of the algebra of function germs. And this notion of derivations of an algebra we will encounter several times in this course when we define all sorts of derivatives, covariant derivative, exterior derivatives, and so on. They generally will be derivations, not entirely all of them, but almost all of them will be derivations of an algebra. So the tangent space is the set of derivations, so-called derivations, of an associative algebra. That is to say, well, what is a derivation? A derivation is a linear map from the algebra, in this case into the reals, which obey, and this is really what makes the linear map a derivation, it has to obey the Leibniz rule. Okay? So the abstract definition of a derivation is that it's a linear map from an algebra into numbers or another algebra such that it obeys the Leibniz rule. That's a derivation. Special case will be derivatives. All right, so let's look at this carefully. Tangent space is the set of derivations, so linear maps obeying the Leibniz rule, are derivations of this algebra. So it's the set of linear maps from the algebra into R, which obey this thing. So what does it really do? This is a tangent vector. If it is linear, and when you feed it a function germ, and that function germ is the product of two function germs, then it's got to be the tangent vector evaluated, or the directional derivative evaluated on the first function germ, multiplied with the value of the second function germ, plus the other way around. Now that might look a little strange here with all those bars, but it shouldn't be. This, after all, is going to be a real number. That's going to be a real number. That's a real number. That's a real number. Just evaluating directional derivatives here. By the way, what is this real number here? We're evaluating a function germ at the point P. Now remember, function germ is an equivalence class of functions which all agree on what they do in an open set around P. So in particular, they all agree on what they do at P itself. Therefore, this is actually G of P. See, G of P is the function that we used to generate a function germ. Right? You take an arbitrary function, and it will generate for you an equivalence class of functions about P. Namely, if you have your function, then all those functions that do exactly the same thing in an open environment, an open neighborhood of P, will belong to that function germ, right? So if we take this function that we use to define the function germ and evaluate it at P, you get exactly the same value that any other element of that equivalence class would do. So this is a number which is G of P itself. Let's keep that in mind, that if you take a function germ and you evaluate it at the point P, you get what the generating function does at the point P. All right. So this is concretely now for differentiable manifolds, but much more generally, keep in mind the pattern that you see here. The pattern is that we have an associative algebra, in this case f of p, and then we define derivations to be linear maps from that algebra into, in this case, the real numbers, such that the Leibniz rule is obeyed. Those linear maps are called derivations, and they will turn out to be derivatives. So the various kinds of derivatives, as I said, will, at least the first derivatives, will be derivations. Let me remark something just to illustrate how powerful that is. This definition is abstract enough, not only for arbitrary differentiable manifolds. I mean, as I said, we will see that exterior derivatives, for example, on the Grassmann algebra of differentiable forms, are also just derivations of an algebra. No, it's more than that. This definition can be applied even when a Newton-Leibniz kind of definition with limit taking is simply not available. So for example, in so-called non-commutative geometry, you can also define algebras of functions that may, for example, be non-commutative. And then you can say, well, what are the derivations of this algebra of functions, even if it's non-commutative, like the quantum phase space, but more generally, get non-commutative algebras and consider their derivations. But these non-commutative algebras can never be algebras of functions, of ordinary functions, right? Because if it's just a function into the reals, well, functions into the reals are always commutative because the real numbers are commutative, right? So as soon as you go to non-commutativity, that goes out of the window, and you can't do the Newton-Leibniz anymore. But you can still do this definition of linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. Yeah, and that is the starting point, for example, for non-commutative geometry, which is an attempt at quantum gravity and at defining, deriving the standard model of particle physics. Okay, let's look at our, let's go back to ordinary differential geometry. Very, very simple example, a constant function C and its germ C bar. So here's a manifold, differentiable manifold, here's a point. We are mapping this manifold into the real line. That's a manifold too, after all. And there are plenty of functions and plenty of function germs and so on. Let us look at a particular function and the germ that it generates. Let us look at a particular function that we call C. And that function does the following. It maps all points of the manifold into the number C. It's a constant function, okay? So it maps all points of the manifold into the number C, constant function. Now, at the point P, it generates a function germ. A function is said to be in the function germ generated by C if it agrees with what C does in some open neighborhood of P. So any function that is taking the value C in a constant fashion in some open neighborhood of P is in the function germ of C. Okay? So the function germ of C doesn't consist of functions that are all constant. No, they could do wild things over here. But they qualify for being in the equivalence class, in the German equivalence class of C, if there exists an open neighborhood where they output just the constant value C. Okay, so now let us prove that the directional derivative of this function germ, C bar, is equal to zero. So the directional derivative of this function germ generated by C, by the constant function, is zero for all possible directional derivatives, for all the elements of the tangent space, which is to say for all linear maps, which are, well, linear, and obey the Leibniz rule. Okay, so let's calculate. The directional derivative on C bar is by a property that we saw earlier, namely that we can pull constant values out of the equivalence class, right? So we can pull the C out of this, then it's C as a real number times the 1 bar. And then xi is a linear function, huh? The linear function, linear map, so we can pull it out of that. So it's just C times xi of 1. But this is equal to C times, C being a number now, the directional derivative of 1 times 1. Actually, we should put bars on these, right? But it's kind of tedious. So it's xi of 1 times 1, because the function germ of 1 times 1 is the same as the function germ of 1. But by the Leibniz rule, we know that the directional derivative on the product of two functions or two function germs is given by the directional derivative of the first times the second plus the first times the directional derivative of the second. But this is now twice c times xi of 1. So what we derived is that 1 times c xi of 1 is 2 times c xi of 1. And therefore, xi of c bar has to be 0. Okay. And notice that we showed that without taking any Newton-Leibniz limit. Now let's look at a more interesting case here. The case where the manifold is Rn. Now let's test our algebraic definition of tangent vectors. Is it really good? If it is good, it should reproduce what we think we know should be the space of directional derivatives on Rn. Okay, so if our definition for the tangent space, our algebraic definition of the tangent space is any good, we expect that every psi in the tangent space, so any linear map obeying the Leibniz rule, is of the form like this. Because this is, we know, how directional derivatives look like in Rn. But this is not how we are given the tangent vectors. We are given tangent vectors in a much more abstract way. We only know that they are linear maps obeying the Leibniz rule. Does that mean that they can be written in this form, that they are a linear combination of the partial derivatives? It's a bit like asking, if we know a function obeys this, how do we know it's of that form? So we define them as linear maps obeying the Leibniz rule. Now we want to check whether that implies that these linear maps obeying the Leibniz rule can be written in this form as being the weighted sum of directional of partial derivatives, and therefore, in the intuitive sense, directional derivatives. So now let's prove this. And this proof is actually a little bit more tedious than proving that the function that obeys that is this series. So brace yourself, it's going to be a little tedious. But you don't have to remember the details of this. Just get out the gist of this. That's the main point. OK, so we choose P to have the coordinates x equals 0, 0, 0, 0. So in our chart, it's the origin. That's our point P. We can choose that without restricting generality. Now let's assume that xi is one of these tangent vectors. That is to say, it's a linear map obeying the Leibniz rule. And that f is some function germ. We want to find out how xi acts on f bar. And we want to see whether it is really the action of psi on f bar is really of that form. So psi of f bar should be sum over psi I derivatives of the f. Is it really? Let me start with reminding you of the Einstein notation. If we have a function of multiple variables, then in this course, the partial derivatives with respect to these individual variables will often be written simply as commas. So the derivative with respect to the ith variable will simply h comma I. Okay? It's just a convenient way of writing derivatives. Then let's go through the proof. So what we want to calculate is the action of one of our tangent vectors defined as a linear map obeying the Leibniz rule on the function germ. Now we can write it in the following way. It is the tangent vector applied to this sum. After all, we've just taken what we had and we added and then subtracted something. Now what is it we added and subtracted? This is the original function germ. So f is some arbitrary function, it generates some germ. But what are these guys? These are constant. F of 0 is an actual number. And then by putting the bar on it, it's just like our C before. It's a constant function, and this is the function germ generated by a constant function, and the same here too. Okay, so now we use the fact that whether we first add or subtract two functions and then form the germ, or we first form the germ and then add and subtract, doesn't matter. That was one of the things we observed earlier. Which means that we can put this bar over the whole thing and then have the difference between f of x and f of 0. Okay, so this is the same as f of x minus f of 0, bar over the whole thing. But this means we can write f of x minus f of 0 as the integral over the derivative. By the fundamental theorem of calculus, it's just the integral over the derivative of f in this way, where we do the bar later at the end. Okay. Then we use that the formation of function germs is linear. So here we have the psi is a linear map, and we have to apply it to this function germ plus that function germ. So this is the linear map acting on the first function germ plus the linear map acting on the second function germ. So all we've done is that instead of applying psi to all of it at once, we apply psi to this and then add psi to that. Now psi acting on this function germ, because it's the function germ of a constant function, is 0. We calculated that with a C before. Now we have to evaluate what the directional derivative does on all of this. Okay, so it's just spelled out again what we had there. And we also carried out what this derivative did. Right here we have the derivative with respect to t, and that just gives us the xi bar. Just a sec, I didn't mention it, right? Okay. Yes, so this derivative acting on that by the chain rule is the derivative with respect to this variable, that variable, etc. So the derivative with respect to these variables. And then by the chain rule, that chain rule factor here, we're using here that whether we first multiply and then form the germ equivalence class, or first form the germ equivalence class and then multiply, doesn't matter. OK, so after we carry out that derivative with respect to t, which just gets rid of this t and we just have xi bar, we have this expression. By the way, remember what we're calculating before I switch to the next slide and we lose it here. We're calculating the action of our tangent vector on a function germ. So this is supposed to be a number at the end, which is the rate of change of the temperature or something like that. It's a directional derivative of a function or function germ. Okay, so this is what we need to calculate. Now, because psi is a linear map, that obeys the Leibniz rule. Because it's a linear map, this sum can be pulled out of it. So we do that. So we go from here to here by pulling the sum out of this.
Why is why are you using coordinates txi?
Sorry, I don't understand. What's the question?
Why are your coordinates tx1, tx2, txn?
Oh, remember that we introduced this dummy variable t that wasn't existing before, just so that we could write this expression, differentiate it, and then integrate it again. That was just a trick.
Okay, so they're just arbitrary coordinates.
It's just arbitrary, yeah. It works for any coordinate system. We will later use the fact that we chose without restricting generality that the origin of our chart has coordinate zero. The origin of our chart, the point with coordinate 0, 0, 0, is the point P. That's what we will use in a moment. That's why we had here the 0, 0, et cetera. But it's not clear at that stage, but it will become clear in a moment. OK, so we just pulled out the summation here. OK, and now what do we have? We have to evaluate the directional derivative, the tangent vector, on product of functions, right? There is this function, actually the function germ. We could put this bar over the whole thing. We have to apply this. We have to apply that directional derivative on the product of this function and that function. This is a case for the Leibniz rule. Remember, we haven't used the Leibniz rule yet. It ought to be important that we have it. OK, so the Leibniz rule can now be applied to this product of two functions. What we get is that we have to take the directional derivative, tangent vector, and apply it to the first of the two functions. That's the big bracket here. And then multiply with the second function. All of this evaluated at the point in question, which has coordinates x equal to 0. Plus the second term in the Leibniz rule, where we leave the first function the same, but evaluate it at the point in question, the p, and multiply with now the derivative of the second factor here, this one, right? So it's simply xi acting as a derivative on this times that, giving us the derivative of this times that plus this times derivative of that. Now, what is this? This is a function germ of the function of the coordinate function xi. And it's to be evaluated at the point p, which is x equal to 0, which is the value 0. Remember that all the functions in the germ will take the same value at the point p. And that value is 0. So therefore, the first term actually goes away. Only the second term survives here. OK, so let's pull this thing in front. So what we have is that it's the sum over the directional derivatives of the function germs of the coordinate functions multiplied with this thing evaluated at the point, at the point P. Which is to say at the origin of the coordinate system. But at the origin of the coordinate system, the x's are all 0. So therefore, what this reduces to is the integral from 0 to 1 of the partial derivatives of f evaluated at 0, which is to say that this is constant. This is just a number. But if you integrate a number from 0 to 1, you get the exact same number back. So therefore, all of this is really just the derivatives now spelled out again. Here I was a bit lazy. I wrote comma I, but it's really d by dxi of the f evaluated at the point in question, at 0. Right? And we have these coefficients in front. Now we are done. Now we are done, because remember what we set out to prove. we set out to prove that every linear map obeying the Leibniz rule is of the expected form. It is a directional derivative. It has the form of some weights, some coefficients, times the partial derivatives. That's what we set out to prove. And what we did find is that indeed, when we apply xi onto a function germ f, this is what we get. These are the partial derivatives, okay? And these are going to be the weights. So what we identified here is not only that we get a directional derivative, but we also identified what these weights are. I mean, we identified that these weights are the evaluation of the directional derivative on the coordinate functions. Okay, so what we, just to summarize it again, what we showed is that in the case where the manifold is Rn, we showed that if you pick a point P, then any linear map of function germs into real numbers, function germs about the point P into real numbers, any such linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule is actually of this form. So it's actually a linear combination of these derivatives with respect to the various cardinal directions, weighted, and therefore it's a directional derivative in arbitrary directions, where the actual direction is given by these values. What the map does with these coordinate functions. This means that if we know how our tangent vectors act on these coordinate functions, then we know how they act on any function. Namely, in this way. We get the code, we get these coefficients over here, and then we have to differentiate these functions there. Okay, so notice how a tangent vector acts on the coordinate function x bar I, or germ of a coordinate function, gives us xi, and therefore we now know how the tangent vector xi acts on all function germs, namely through 1. Oop. Let me show this, right? So now this was a very simple example. Where the manifold was Rn, and we knew what to expect. So we are simply recovering what we expected. It's like when we work with the exponential function, we know what it's supposed to be, and then somebody comes along and says, hey, you can just specify this function by giving these two properties. See, by the way, you need this property because otherwise, 5 times that function will also obey that property. 5 times the exponential function also has the property that it agrees with its derivative. So you need that normalization condition too. Yeah, so basically all we did was we showed that these abstract conditions, in this case, the xi have to be linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule, translated into the concrete representation as directional derivatives, as weighted derivatives, right? Similar to these abstract conditions translating into the an coefficients having to be 1 over n factorial. Okay, so this was a very simple example. But then how does our definition of the tangent vector space work generally for abstract differentiable manifolds? Now, let's remember how far we got with this so far with working with the abstract differentiable manifolds. So we have an abstract differentiable manifold M, we have a point, and we have a chart that maps from the manifold into Rn. I mean, generally, it might not map all of it into all of Rn. It could be mapping a patch into a patch. But that's not so important now. So what H does is it gives every point in the manifold, every abstract point here, a name, namely an n-tuple of real numbers. OK. Now, how do we make, I mean, in this way, we can suddenly actually talk about these points concretely. We can say this point, and by that I mean the point with such and such coordinates, and that point, and by that I mean the point with such and such coordinates. Now, a similar challenge arises. Let's look at the tangent space to the point P. How can we talk about the tangent vectors in there? We can, of course, say that the tangent space to the points to the point P of that manifold consists of all linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. But we need a representation in terms of numbers to actually specify this is the one map and this is the other map. Right? So far we only have a tool to describe the tangent space abstractly as the set of all the linear maps which map the function germs around P into real numbers obeying in such a way that they obey the Leibniz rule. But how to make it explicit? How to give sort of kind of coordinates for the vectors in this tangent space? How do we parameterize them properly so that we can work with them? So how can we make this psi in TP of M concrete? Of course, you may already guess it. The way we do it is that we get a map into tangent spaces over there. Because we just established the tangent spaces in Rn in the sense that we can write them down as coefficients times partial derivatives, are in one-to-one correspondence to the linear maps obeying the Leibniz rule. So we know all of this business over here. So this map should induce for us also an understanding of the tangent vectors over here. Just like this map gives us an understanding of the points here, it might also induce an understanding of the tangent vectors over here. And it does. And it's going to be a little abstract, but I think you can handle it. OK. Let's start with diffeomorphisms, differentiable isomorphisms. So here's our manifold, M, and here we have a point. Let us now look at the diffeomorphism, let's call it phi, which maps either the entire M into the entire N, or maybe just a patch. It doesn't really matter whether it's just a patch or all of it. OK, so differentiable map here from M into N. If they're of the same dimension, we will generally require phi to be invertible, but they don't have to be of the same dimension. This could be Rn, Rm, it could be some other manifold, or it could be R, could be C, could be all sorts of spaces. OK, so here we have a diffeomorphism phi. Now, the special case that often comes up is where n, the second manifold, is Rn. In this case, we would call this a chart. It's a coordinate system. But that's just a special case. So let's just generally look at the case where we have two manifolds and we map the diffeomorphism from M to N. This case will come up relatively rarely. But for what we do now, we might as well consider the general case. It's just as difficult or just as easy as if we specified here Rn. OK. Now, so we have this diffeomorphism from this manifold into that manifold. And in the case where this is Rn, this will provide names for the points here. But that's the purpose of a chart or a coordinate system, right? But if it's not Rn, if it's just an arbitrary manifold n, let's just consider this diffeomorphism. Now, my claim is that this diffeomorphism will generate a map from the algebra of function germs around Q into the algebra of function germs around P. We will have to talk about function germs in order to get to the tangent spaces. So it's an intermediate step that's necessary. But why would that be? Why would a diffeomorphism between the manifolds induce an algebra homomorphism? So an algebra operation respecting map from the algebra of function germs around Q into the algebra of function germs around P. But the reason is this. imagine you have a function germ here over this manifold. All right, so let's just consider a function for simplicity. It could be the function that generates a function germ. So let's consider a function here. A function in this set, a point in this set, the g. The g is a function over that manifold, right, in the neighborhood of q, function germ. This g is a function over that manifold. It maps points in the manifold into real numbers. How can we map that into a function over that manifold? Very easily. If you have a function over that manifold, consider prepending that function, a diffeomorphism. Right? Now, you can take any point in here, map it through the diffeomorphism into here, and then feed it into our function. This composite function is a function that lives here, because it takes its input in this set, in this set of points, right? So you now can take any point in here, map it with a diffeomorphism into that set, and then feed it into our function. That composite function now lives over there. It takes as its input elements in here. So therefore, what we have is that a diffeomorphism from this manifold into that manifold induces a map of functions over that manifold into a map of functions over that manifold, simply by prepending the diffeomorphism onto the functions that live over here, just by prepending, right?
So yeah. What's that word you mean, prepending?
Well, instead of appending.
Okay.
I will write it down mathematically in a moment. So it's a composition, right? So we first apply that map and then the other one. Yeah?
So those are like pullbacks and pushbacks, right?
Yes, we will get pullbacks and push forwards, yeah. Okay. And as you may already be able to anticipate, this continues, right? Now we have a map from here to here, and then we can have another structure down there, and then it goes from here to here, right? It will go on like this. Okay, so this is going to be an algebra homomorphism. Let's not bother proving that it actually respects the algebra structure, but it does. Okay, so the diffeomorphism is phi, and then this algebra homomorphism will be called phi star. Okay, so f of q is the algebra of function germs around q, and the elements are called g. An element may be called g, and it's mapped into an element f of the algebra of function germs around p. And how does it work? Well, phi star is mapping a function germ g into a function germ f over here. So it's phi star of g in such a way that f, this function, is given by starting here, then applying the diffeomorphism phi, arriving over here, and then applying g, getting a real number. So overall, this whole thing is a map from points in here into the real numbers. And the same then for the function germs. And this prepending, it's like an appendix is at the end, the prependix is before, can be written in this way. Remember this little circle here is the common mathematical language for concatenating two functions, feeding the output of this function as input into this function. So we take the diffeomorphism, which takes us from that manifold into that manifold, and then the output is a point in this manifold we feed into G. So phi star is diffeomorphism and then G. So F is G after phi. Let's remember that equation. Let's give it a plus. Okay. So another level. And you can see how if we kept going with this, it would go always back and forth, back and forth. So now remember what tangent spaces do. A tangent vector is, according to the algebraic definition, a map, a linear map, which take as input function germs and output numbers, linear maps which obey the Leibniz rule. But in particular, the linear maps that feed on function germs and output real numbers. So in particular, they take, you know, an element from here and output real numbers. So if you take any tangent vector, it will feed on an element in here and output a real number. Now imagine you take an element in here, a function germ in here, and then map it with phi star into there, then you can feed it into our tangent vector. Which means that now you have a map which takes as input a function germ over here and outputs a real number. These are those guys, right? The tangent vectors here, they take as input function germs here and output real numbers. So we have to check, of course, that the Leibniz rule is obeyed and linearity and all of that. But if you wish, you can check that. Let's not spend time on this. Okay. So what we have is that this algebra homomorphism induces a vector space isomorphism. So any tangent vector here is mapped into a tangent vector over there. Now that's cool because this could be Rn, okay? And this could be our general manifold. If this is Rn, then this would be the tangent space to P, another Rn, which we know can be written as weight coefficients times directional times the derivatives in the various directions. And so what we now have is just like the points on the manifold map into points in Rn, giving them names. We now also have that the tangent vectors to this point, in the tangent space to this point, map through this linear map into tangent vectors to that point. And we know how to identify them by their coefficients. We know that all, we just proved this tediously, that all linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule in the case of Rn have the form coefficient xi I times d by dxi, sum over I. So therefore, by specifying those coefficients, we are specifying tangent vectors over there. Okay, and this map is called phi star, and that map is called the tangent map tp phi. So tp phi is not a tangent space, even though there's a capital T. It's the tangent map to phi at the point P. Okay, so tp phi maps tangent vectors, the tangent space at the point P of M into the tangent space of the point Q, which is the image of P, in the manifold N. And it maps tangent vectors psi into tangent vectors eta of the other tangent space of the other manifold. And in particular, the eta, the tangent vector, is obtained again by concatenation, by prepending the phi star. Right? It's exactly the same way as we did before, concatenation. And the eta of the G is psi of, and then the phi star of G. And then from that equation plus, if you remember. This one, namely that F is obtained by concatenating phi with G. Phi with G, we have that the image of under the tangent map of G is given by xi applied to G concatenated after phi. Okay, let us look at the crucial special case, namely where indeed the second manifold is Rn itself. So the second manifold is Rn. It has the same dimension as the manifold M that we start with. We assume that phi is invertible. We want this to be a chart, after all. Then phi star is an algebra isomorphism. It's not just an algebra homomorphism. It's an algebra isomorphism. And the tangent map is a vector space isomorphism. Again, because now that they're of the same dimension, they can be isomorphic. So now we obtain a concrete handle on the abstract tension space vectors given a chart. Remember, here's our abstract manifold, point P. The chart gives us names for the points of the manifold, namely the coordinates in Rn that the images have. And we also already worked out how this behaves under changes of chart. Right? Now, what we have is that the diffeomorphism generates an algebra homomorphism the other direction, which generates a linear map between the tangent spaces. And therefore, what we have is that given a chart phi, every abstract point in P has a concrete, every abstract point P has a concrete image in Rn, so we can describe the points by a set of n real numbers, but also every abstract tangent vector xi in the tangent space of the manifold now has uniquely a concrete image in the tangent space of the point P in the manifold Rn. Namely, the image is the image under the tangent map. Remember, Tp phi is the tangent map of xi. Right? All I'm saying is that, this is the abstract tangent vector. And every abstract tangent vector is mapped through Tp phi into some tangent vector over there, which is given by n coefficients xi I. Okay. So the image eta is concrete because eta is a tangent vector at a point in Rn. I feel like I've said that many times now. Okay. And we showed that tangent vectors in Rn, we showed that tediously. Remember, that was this long, tedious proof. We showed that tangent vectors in Rn always take this form. So therefore, since any tangent vector to any point in Rn can be specified as a linear combination of the derivatives at this point, with these weight coefficients specify for us also the abstract tangent vector of which this is the image. Okay, so that's really going on in differential geometry. And conversely, if we have a fixed phi, then any choice of q in Rn denotes a point P, and any choice of eta coefficients denotes a tangent vector. So, all I'm saying is that we can view it two ways. We can say that since these are in one-to-one correspondence, we can say that the abstract points are getting names, and the abstract tangent vectors are getting names in the form of n coordinates. But you can also operate the other way around, and you can start with these numbers and say they denote for me points and tangent vectors in the manifold. By the way, we work with concrete numbers, even though we can work now with concrete numbers, these coefficients, even though we are really dealing with an abstract manifold and abstract tangent spaces on them. And notice that we did not need to take any limits. Okay, so that was without any Newton-Leibniz derivatives. Right, now I should say something as a warning about the literature. So for example, the tangent vector given by this particular directional derivative, the derivative in the I direction, is the image of some abstract tangent vector to some abstract point of the manifold given once we are given the diffeomorphism or once we're given the chart. Now, often in the literature, you will find that, especially in the later chapters, people get a little sloppy. And they will say that the abstract tangent vector to the abstract point on the manifold is given by d by dxi. It's not, of course. This is the image of the abstract tangent vector. They're simply sloppy in identifying these things. So they're giving this as a name to the abstract thing, but it's not true. Really, there is a map in between. And just keep that in mind. So this is just a symbolic notation. What they really mean is, if you choose a chart, then under that chart, your attention vector has the coefficients 0, 0, 0, and then in the ith entry, it has 1 and then 0, 0, 0 again. It's unfortunate because, strictly speaking, this is not a correct notation. Okay, so what will we do next then? Well, if we hold the point P in the manifold fixed, if we hold the tangent vector fixed, but we change the chart, when we change coordinate system, then what? Now, we already know how to do the change of coordinate system for the coordinates of a point. And next, we will see how the coefficients change when the coefficients of a tangent vector change when we change coordinates. Okay, and then after that, we will do the definition, the physicist's definition, and the geometric definition of tangent spaces as one, and we will as well. And we will see how they are all isomorphic to each other in the case of ordinary differentiable manifolds. In the case of non-commutative geometry, some of them, I mean, only the algebraic one survives. But generally, the algebraic one was good to introduce today because that's the way modern differential geometry introduces basically every derivation. Every derivative will be defined through its linearity and obeying the Leibniz rule. So we will see that the general way to introduce derivatives is to say, here's an algebra, and we're looking at the set of derivations of that algebra. This will be the set of linear maps obeying the Leibniz rule, and they will be the derivatives of the elements of the algebra. Okay, any questions about today's stuff?
I noticed you didn't define our diffeomorphisms morphisms to be invertible.
Not necessarily. Remember that sometimes we had the map into R. And then, of course, from Rn into R, it can't be invertible. For a chart, we want it to be invertible.